You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast.
We are an assault team, just six of us. This is my first patrol. I'm thinking, it's a beautiful country.
There's these stacks of rocks, Taliban fighting positions. I start walking over there, camera in hand, taking pictures, making sure we get all this documented. Holy cow. These rounds are hitting inches away from me.
These guys are shooting at me. Yeah, welcome to Afghanistan.
Hi, Mom.
We knew that only 50% of us would make it back.
The Taliban knew where we were.
Hey, I got video of it.
You do?
That's a preview of a new 5-part documentary reality series called Taking Fire, which premieres Tuesday night, September 13th at 10 p.m. Eastern on the Discovery Channel. It follows a handful of rookies with the Army's famous 101st Airborne Division who in 2010 packed helmet cameras to film their one-year deployment to the farthest-flung region of the Taliban-held Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. The footage they brought back charts an extraordinary first-eye view of modern warfare in one of the deadliest places on Earth, and it plunges viewers into the heart of the action for a visceral experience unlike anything previously captured by news reporters and traditional documentaries. Today, I'll talk with the two men who did triple duty as soldiers, cameramen, and stars of this unconventional series, Privates Kyle Boucher and J.J. McCool. They'll reveal how they were able to film this remarkable footage without interference from the Pentagon brass and some of the risks they took to get the perfect shot. I'm talking film shots and gunshots. They'll discuss the creepy feeling of fighting an enemy they couldn't see but who was constantly watching them. And we'll talk about their, at times, frustrating working relationship with the Afghan National Army and the local police forces. Plus, getting shot in the shower, getting shot at dinner, and the world's deadliest gym. Believe me, folks, there's a reason this show is called Taking Fire. And we'll hear all about it with Privates J.J. McCool and Kyle Boucher in just a moment. The Discovery Channel's new show, Taking Fire, follows a six-man assault team with the Army's 101st Airborne on their deployment to a far-flung outpost in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley back in 2010. This innovative series was shot entirely by the soldiers themselves through a mix of helmet and digital cameras. The first episode airs Tuesday night on Discovery Channel, and today I'm talking with the two soldiers who were both cameramen and stars of the show, J.J. McCool and Kyle Boucher. Guys, thanks for joining me, and more importantly, thank you for your service.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
It's my pleasure.
So tell me, how did this project come about?
Well, basically, a few of the guys just decided to buy helmet cameras for, you know, documenting what happened throughout the deployment. We made the decision to, buy helmet cameras. We had no intentions on this becoming what it is now. We just wanted to be able to look back and, remember what we did. And it was good to have throughout the deployment. We could always look back at, like, what happened. Kind of like, we did this good, we did this good, we could have done better this, stuff like that. We knew we were going on a pretty, pretty tough deployment, and we just wanted to capture what happened.
Okay, so this didn't come from the military or the Discovery Channel. This was you guys' idea.
Well, I guess the origin of it happened when we knew we were going to deploy, and our commander told us about 3 months out that where we were going, we had a 50% chance of coming back.
Wow.
So when I found that out, I've always been one to record anything crazy that I've done, whether it's cliff diving off, into lakes or bridge jumping, anything. So I was figured, hey, if it's that bad and there's going to be that much activity, I may as well record what I can.
And how did you guys sell the Army on this idea? Did they express any hesitancy that this might be a distraction or hinder your mission?
No, I mean, I guess really we were in such a remote location that, nobody really came up and bothered us where we were. I mean, we were just out there in the fight, and the Army really didn't have any concern I mean, plus we're all most of us are out of the Army now, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, you know what they say, it's easier to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission. So did the higher ups even know about this?
Who knows? We didn't really ask permission. I mean, there was no embedded reporters. This is all filmed by us.
They didn't really know about it. I mean, our command within our platoon and company knew about it, and there was nothing. I mean, there was no real checks and balances or, hey, you can or can't do this. It was kind of new because the technology, like I said, just wasn't really there for helmet cameras. I mean, it's not like there were nice GoPros and things like that like they have now. So the way that I kind of equate it, though, is it's like cops wearing cameras now.
Right.
I mean, it's in everyone's best interest for the cop to wear that camera because they should be conducting themselves in a way that's professional and morally sound, so on and so forth. So that's just another check and balance for us in those situations to make sure that we're doing everything that we know to be right and executing the way that we should. And I think the idea as we got into it was, hey, let's, try and compile this footage and make some kind of something, like a Restrepo or a hornet's nest, something like that,
Yeah, the military tends to be very careful when they're embedding reporters on the battlefield. So you weren't at all concerned that at some point the higher-ups were going to shut this down?
No, and, where we were, and you'll see, and the viewers will see as they kind of watch it, I mean, we were in the wild, wild west is kind of what we called it. So just in the middle of the Pesh, left out, almost not high and dry, but I mean, it was a constant fight. And a lot of the higher ups wouldn't even come to our cop, let alone see what you're recording, So we didn't even have civilian contractors that would come over and work on anything, our internet, or for whatever reason, anything goes out. I mean, we were kind of stuck.
Wow.
Because it was too dangerous for the civilians to come out. And I mean, none of the brass or higher ups really even came out. And I think that even if they did, they wouldn't have been against it.
Have you gotten any response from the Army now that it's about to go on the Discovery Channel, or any reaction?
No, I haven't personally. I think moving forward, as Ra put together this docuseries, they had to get some DOD approval just as they were submitting the edits and the rough cuts, just to make sure there wasn't anything, for whatever reason, that shouldn't be on there.
Right.
But it never really was a thought of mine. And it's still, I mean, even now, no one has contacted me.
And I don't think that anywhere on any of that footage there was anything we did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that they would really have a reason to say, hey, let's try and conceal this footage.
So let's talk about the production side of this. You guys jerry-rigged these helmet cams yourselves. Were these GoPro cameras, or what were you working with here?
They're called Contour HD. They were like the prequel to the GoPro. And the nice thing about it was it had a really low profile. So I was able to mount it just on the side of my helmet, as you see in a lot of the footage. And you kind of got, you would see exactly what I was seeing.
Yeah, well, I think that it looks quite good for what you were working with there. So you didn't find yourself going back out into the line of fire to capture a shot or anything?
you didn't
escape with your life and say, oh, we got to go back out. We lost the shot.
I'm not going to say I didn't do that because...
You sound a little nuts to me, JJ.
More than a few times.
Okay.
And, when you're so often in those situations, it almost – I don't want to say you get kind of crazier or you want to be more daring, but it is almost like that because it's so familiar. You almost want to take one step further out or, do something that was a little more than what you did in the last firefight so that it still keeps that – because – that, I don't know, there's a feeling you get when you're being shot at, as weird as that sounds. I mean, it's an adrenaline rush, and it's something that you've never felt before. And it's like any experience. I mean, there's that high, and then as you continue to do the same thing over and over, you don't get quite that rush.
You were there in 2010, which was around the peak of the surge in Afghanistan. What was your mission?
We basically were there to work ourselves out of a job. We trained the ANA. The ANA came out with us on almost every mission. Eventually our mission was to turn over the war to the Afghan National Army and the people of Afghanistan.
I don't even remember exactly what Obama was saying our mission was. Go over there, try and do the whole win the hearts and minds, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of times that just means, hey, we're going to go talk to them about their hydropower plant, or we're going to go meet with the elders and see if we can't build them a bridge across the river, and or if they have lighting issues. It's just simple, small things that seem very petty probably to us as Americans, but are very important to them. And that was kind of how we wanted to win their hearts and minds so that we could essentially get them on our side. Because if we had the villagers and the elders, then they would let us know when the Taliban were moving through and we could essentially take care of them. And so I guess you kind of think that that's the mission,
Mm-hmm.
But very quickly, especially where we learned that the mission every day was just making sure the guy to your left and right got back home safely. And that's kind of what it ended up being, because every day it was just nonstop.
Taking fire seems like the perfect title for this show, because I'm watching this and the enemy is constantly taking pot shots all day long at you guys. You're getting shot everywhere, even on the outpost. I mean, did you ever have a moment's peace?
That was the world we lived in. We were on Cop Michigan. We took fire every single day. We went out on missions and got into numerous gunfights. Cop Michigan was it's like shooting fish in a barrel. These guys came up over the mountains. They'd blast RPGs at us, small arms fire, recoilless rifles, mortars, everything they had. They'd try getting us, and we fought right back.
It was nice in the sense that you never got complacent. For us, it was like every day we knew something was going to happen. It was just a matter of when and how many times. I mean, we were in almost every situation. We had casualties. We had KIAs, wounded. We called it nine lines. We did all kinds of gun runs. We had every air asset you can imagine. So you really kind of ran the full gambit of it. And it really was. Taking fire is a pretty appropriate name.
Yeah, because you just weren't getting shot at when you were in some kind of a combat situation out in the field. Even when you were at your base camp at Cop Michigan, you guys are talking about getting shot at in the shower and getting shot at at dinner.
Yeah, people were getting hit in the showers or people, Lord. Just anywhere. So it really, the way that we had it, and you have to imagine how tactically inefficient this seems, that we have a base right in the middle of a valley surrounded by mountains that are thousands of feet above us, and they can sit in these rock formations all over around us just lobbing anything they want. You know, whether that's grenades, RPGs, recoilless rounds, Dishka, small arms fire, whatever that may be. And knowing that when you're on base, I mean, there's not a lot you can do. It was Men's Health or Men's Journal, I think, did an article while we were there. We had the deadliest gym on Earth. So I think just during my time there, we had, it was five Purple Hearts given out just for people working out in our little makeshift gym.
Well, now that you're back in civilian life, next time you run into one of these CrossFit fanatics that think they're so badass, you tell them about the world's deadliest gym. I think that'll shut them up pretty quick.
And, you know, you would think that, and I probably could, but if they don't experience a deployment like that, they just really have no way to even relate to what that means. It's a difficult thing, you know?
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Privates Kyle Boucher and J.J. McCool of Discovery Channel's Taking Fire when we come back in just a minute. Hey, folks. Do you like reading but find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work or working out at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles entirely for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. It's spooky watching this because it kind of reminds me of that old horror movie, The Hills Have Eyes, because you guys are always in a valley, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
The enemy is always has the high ground. They're in the mountains. Good. You can't even see them with all the rocks and the shadows.
Absolutely.
You do. You constantly feel, you know, when you're walking to chow, or you're walking to the motor pool, or you're going to your guard tower for guard duty. You always feel like somebody's watching you, but when you're in a place like that, you don't really have time to let your guard down.
It seems like you guys were kind of really at a strategic disadvantage in that sense.
Well, in that sense, and the sense that, I mean, that's their home. You know, these people grew up around there. They ran around those mountains all their life, you know? I mean, they don't wear uniforms. They run around. They can hide anywhere they want. They know the land. They don't have any restrictions on firing at you. They're always the ones to fire first, so they always have the element of surprise. So you always find yourself in this reactive form where you're trying to adjust to what they're doing, and I mean, you just don't know when it's going to happen or where it's going to come from or what it's going to be this time.
How do you even begin to fight an enemy like that?
You start to see some signs, you know, when something could happen or when it was likely to happen. I mean, kids would start going inside. People would start leaving the streets. You know, they'd like move their livestock in, so on and so forth. So you could start to see these indications that something may or may not happen, right?
Really?
But I mean, they have their radios, they have their smoke signals, and all that seems very primitive, but it's effective.
Wow.
And they had some systems set in place that made them, I mean, really effective for as simplistic as they are and with the lack of resources they have. The element of surprise is the biggest thing in warfare. And then, of course, being on high ground all the time is huge.
Yeah.
So, and when we have to abide by things like the rules of engagement, of course, right? And they're firing at us from a house and we can't do anything about that. You know, it's like where our hands are tied quite often.
And Cop Michigan has a very claustrophobic feeling to it because the whole outpost is designed as a series of mazes intended to keep you guys out of the open as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It really was a maze. We almost built like a rat's nest. I mean, everything was covered or at least concealed where they couldn't see you or they couldn't directly shoot you. Everything had T-walls up. You had HESCOs everywhere, sandbags on everything. And I mean, even with all of that and all the force pro, they call it, which is just basically building up your positions and fortifying things. I mean, you couldn't keep up with it. And you couldn't get to the point where any place was really safe.
We had the Tunnel of Love, which was this long tunnel made up of two HESCOs on each side and a wall over the top of it with three or four layers of sandbags. And you'd run through it, and during a fire, base would be taking contact, and you might be in the gym, you might be in the chow hall, and you got to run back and get with your team leader to let him know you're all right. And I mean, it was kind of fun.
One other fun thing about it is it looks like you got to play with some pretty great big boy toys there and some military tech that I've never seen before. Talk about some of the cool tech that you guys had at your disposal there.
Delta Company platoons are what they call heavy weapons platoons, and they usually have the bigger weapons than a normal line infantry unit would have. So we had the Modus or the 50 cal, right? We had a tow machine, and we had
and
with
a tow
us,
truck is yeah. not what we here in civilian life think of as a tow truck, right?
Absolutely not. So a tow is a fly-by-wire rocket, and it has Gen 2 optics on it. So basically, you can scan all around you. You can see anything, whether it's a goat on the mountain or a person, and then you can shoot this pretty serious rocket that goes, I think the maximum range is just under 2 miles, and it's fly-by-wire, and what that means is there's a very small wire that's connected to it that allows you to control the path of that rocket in flight.
A literal wire?
A literal wire, oh. Yes. Imagine
basically
a metal fishing line. That's about as thin as it is. That would be what would control the rocket.
Yeah, and I was interested to hear that the vehicles that you guys would drive in had some kind of a system that would detect what direction the bullets were coming from.
It was like a shot spotter. Basically, if you take an incoming bullet or RPG, it would pick up where it came from, give you a distance and direction based on an azimuth. Then you could scan, look where it's coming from and return fire.
Yeah, and much of your mission was working with the local authorities and the local Afghan police. At one point, there's almost a kind of a comical moment when I guess you guys got a report from one of the local policemen that they had found an IED, and you guys go to check on it, and the guy just digs it out of the ground and rips the wires out and hands it to you.
Yeah, very unorthodox, needless to say. So, yeah, a lot of times our intel for missions that we would do would come from the Afghan National Police or the ANA or some kind of contact that would be within a village that we had. So yeah, in a particular situation, there was a time that one of the Afghan National Police had told us that there was an IED that had been implanted in the road just east of our COP, right? And then as we approached it, sure enough, yeah, one of the AMP guys had taken what appeared to be the switch or the detonator off of the implanted IED and had basically brought it to us. So that was a little interesting. I mean, definitely unorthodox and wouldn't be something that we would ever have done. I mean, it wouldn't be something that would be by the book for sure, but they don't do that, you know? I mean, and that's part of the training moving forward is getting them to do things in a way that's a little more safe. I mean, they'll walk over an IED site to jump on it to see, you know, if there's actually something there, which, I mean, if we knew there was an IED implanted or even had intel, we would never do that, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'd obviously assess it, but we wouldn't go jump on it or go play with the wires, you know, and they'll do this all day long.
Yeah. And to some extent, these guys have the most to risk because as locals helping out the coalition forces, they're walking around with a target on their back.
For their families, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, we worked hand in hand with the Afghan National Army. I mean, they were attached to us, and we went on a lot of missions with them. We also worked with the Afghan National Police. A lot of times, those guys got into heavy gunfights with the Taliban themselves. We'd be on COT Michigan, and we'd hear a gunfight go off, and it would be, we'd get spun up, and we'd get out there as fast as we could and help them fight the Taliban. You know, those guys were from Afghanistan. This was their country, and, you know, they wanted what's best for their country. And really, we were just there to help them.
Did you find that they were generally trustworthy, or I'm sure there's a potential for corruption there or intimidation?
I mean, you want to believe the best in everyone.
Sure.
But of course, you also know that there's corruption, and there's tons of stories of Afghan National Army and police killing different soldiers and themselves, so on and so forth. So you're always, I would say, vigilant or watchful. And I mean, you're very meticulous about what you do around them, or, you know, watching your back when they're around. But generally speaking, I mean, we didn't have any issues with our ANA as far as doing anything, I mean, real untrustworthy on our cop. But I personally, I would say I never really trusted them or grew to like them, because I didn't spend a lot of time with them. And the time that I did, they were always doing something incredibly dumb. Like in a like firefight, what? They will sit there and instead of fire and take cover, they will be taking their hats off or their shirt or their shoes and filling it with brass. Or they'll stop an entire mission because they're normally in between two of our assault and our support by fire element, and they'll just stop to pray. When we're compromised in the middle of a mountain, like easily in a bad position, and they'll just think that it's the right time to just start praying.
Yeah, you got to have a lot of faith in Allah there.
Yeah, I'm all about them doing what they need to do, but by the same token, like, I'm not about putting myself or the platoon at risk because they need to pray on the middle of a mountain for no reason, you know? So it's just simple things like that. It's like very frustrating to me. And we just tried to really give them a sense that they could do things. And sometimes they could, sometimes they couldn't. But, I mean, that was kind of the way for us to eventually leave, is to enable them to eventually be able to take care of their own stuff.
And it does seem that much of your mission is about helping the locals rebuild and fighting the so-called Hearts and Minds campaign. Do you feel that you were able to accomplish that?
Yes and no. I mean, where we were was you know, very unevolved. The people there, they, you know, I don't really think a government mattered to them. You know, they grew crops and they were farmers, and they were living the lives the same way they have been for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
However, we were able to help the local villages and everything with you know, helping them build up their villages, helping them with supplies and obviously helping them keep away the Taliban.
Yeah, and you talk about the importance of interacting with the locals and getting a sense of things and building trust. How did you go about building trust with locals?
With respect. You know, you show respect and you earn respect. You try to learn their language and communicate with them. And, you know, if you show them respect, they'll show you respect.
Now, going back to the production aspect, generally, if you're the subject of a reality series or a documentary, it's hard to let your guard down and be real because there's a film crew standing around. But
yeah,
you guys were the film crew, and the cameras were embedded in your heads. So did you find yourselves forgetting that the cameras were rolling and perhaps even occasionally wishing that they hadn't been?
Oh, I mean, you absolutely forget that they're rolling. I can't really think of a time that I like looked back and I was like, oh man, I wish we wouldn't have recorded that. Because even if there was something bad, I mean, you wanted it on video just to at least review and see how you could do something better, mm-hmm. if that was the case, right? But I mean, it was so easy to forget that you were even recording anything, because you're not thinking about it. You know, you have so many different things and responsibilities to be worrying about, especially in my position. Because as we progressed, I had to lay guns on different points. I had to give situational reports back to base. I had to coordinate with the platoon on the ground. I had to see what air assets we have, so on and so forth. So there was so much that was going on all the time that, I mean, once I turned that thing on, it was almost like I forgot. Like I said, it's not produced. You know, it's not like
right. We
were intentionally doing things to try and get it on film. It just was what was. And happened to be captured.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did capture it, because it's amazing to see these things through your eyes and get a visceral feel for the kind of danger our troops put themselves in. What would be the one thing that both of you want Americans to take away from watching this series?
I mean, war is very real. It's not pretty, and at best, it's probably the worst thing that most of us would ever have to endure. But, you know, I really wanted to capture for the people the sacrifice that so many of these great men made. Because when you see, you know, hey, 10 U.S. soldiers died in an attack in Afghanistan. Like, when you hear that as a civilian, and even I find myself sometimes hearing that, and I'm like, oh, that's sad. That's crazy. But it doesn't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
So often when you see tragedy and you're not connected to it, it doesn't mean anything to you. It's just a number, you know? But when you can put faces to those names and a story behind that, it really kind of stands out and makes you realize the sacrifice that so many have made and continue making, and what it really means to put on that uniform and say, hey, I'll do whatever you tell me to do so that we can be free.
Guys get killed over there every day. Two of my best friends got killed, Ben Chisholm and Charlie High. You know, there's been 5,000 plus KIA throughout, you know, the global war on terrorism, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq. And my brothers are going to be able to have their story told. They're going to be memorialized. The entire country is going to know who Ben and Charlie are and know what they did, and they died heroically. I just want my best friend's names to never be forgotten.
You're both out of the Army and enjoying civilian life. What are you guys up to now?
I'm a firefighter now, and I work construction part-time.
Okay, so you're still kind of chasing that adrenaline rush. And JJ, I understand that you have a new baby girl, so congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. I mean, having a new baby girl, I'm enjoying my summer off because I'm a full-time student getting my business degree in school now. Being a 29-year-old going back to college is interesting and presents its own challenges.
Once again, the program is called Taking Fire, and it airs Tuesday night, September 13th on Discovery Channel. Kyle Boucher and JJ McCool, thanks for joining me, and again, thank you for your service.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Kyle and JJ for coming on the show. Watch their 5-part documentary series called Taking Fire, which premieres Tuesday, September 13th at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central on Discovery Channel. To find out more about Taking Fire, visit discovery.com. If you can, follow these brave fellows on Twitter, and I really encourage you to express your gratitude to them for serving our country in the most inhospitable of environments. Now, I haven't been able to find Kyle Boucher on Twitter, but maybe he'll open a Twitter account by the time the show airs. And JJ McCool's Twitter handle is @TeenFalcon13. Don't ask me, folks. I think JJ marches to the beat of his own drum. But definitely check out their show, Taking Fire, on Discovery Channel, Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at Patreon.com/kickassnews. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.